Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison, part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. This week, our very special guest is hospitalist physician at JFK, Dr. Ghazia Pervaiz. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. And thanks for joining us on the program. This is your first appearance, right? On this show.
This is my first appearance, and I'm so happy to be here. Thank you very much for including me in this program.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, because I don't know, at least as long as I've been doing the program, which is a couple years, I don't know that I've ever had a hospitalist, or at least anyone with that title. So what is a hospitalist? What exactly do you do as a hospitalist?
You know, and I just love to talk about it, so let me start by explaining that we are regular physicians, primary care physicians, dedicated to work in a hospital setting. They could be from an internal medicine background, they could be from a family practice background, but essentially a hospitalist is a physician that works with patients admitted to the hospital due to a variety of illnesses or injuries. This is a relatively new specialty, and the need for these specialty practitioners emerged over the last couple of decades from the increasingly complex nature of hospitalized patients. In the past, this care was provided by practitioners who had other clinical obligations. And the most common scenario you'd see is the primary care physician would either start their day or end their day by making rounds in their local hospital and see however many patients they had admitted from their practice there. Mm-hmm. And some people, being a primary, even took call and hence took people that were service patients or people who did not have a primary and were admitted to the hospital on top of their own patients. But what a hospitalist role provides is a dedicated doctor available in the hospital 24/7. So we're there no matter what. In the building, should there be a problem, should there be a change in clinical status.
Okay.
Or for whatever else is needed in order to help the patient get the care they need, get the diagnostics they need, and whatever coordination they need in order for them to have a treatment plan geared towards improvement and eventually a safe transition out of the hospital.
So you're managing the hospital and all the nurses and the ER physician?
We don't manage the ER physicians. The ER physicians are an entirely separate entity. They're the gateway in a sense that they decide whoever comes to the ER, they do a triage, they provide treatment, they try to come up with a plan, and then they decide who needs to be in the hospital as an admitted patient for further treatment.
Okay.
So
okay.
When that decision is made, that is when the emergency department physician is going to pick up the phone and call my team or call me and say, Dr. Pervaiz, we've got a patient that's coming in for a pneumonia or heart failure or with a heart attack or a stroke, and they need to be brought in for this particular reason.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people present with multiple health conditions at once, which could make for a complicated situation.
When that's the case, like how many, are there multiple hospitalists or how does that work?
When that's the case, there's still one hospitalist and they're like the captain of the ship. And based on their diagnostic abilities and based on their assessment about what's clinically going on with the patient, they can call on specialists to assist with their care. But who you call and how soon you call them essentially sets the tone for the patient's hospital stay.
And how do you make that decision? I guess it's based on whatever the situation is with the patient.
Exactly. That's completely based on clinical assessment and what they need done at the time. If somebody has a complicated cardiac history and they present with a pneumonia, they might have medications that interact with the antibiotics I want to give them. In that particular case, we might want to have their cardiologist on board. Other times, somebody may be on a blood thinner coming in with a big bleed, but they need that blood thinner for their heart or for a previous stroke, for example. So in that case, you might want to have their specialists involved to help us out with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest part of it is that when you go see a patient in the ER who's just been told by an ER physician that they're not well enough to go home and they have to be brought into the hospital, in order for further testing and further care, they're at a very vulnerable point. They don't know what's going on. They're obviously very sick, and obviously they're at a point where they're not able to manage their chronic health conditions at home. So walking into that situation can be very stressful. I mean, it's a very stressful situation for the patient. Walking into that, you know, you only have like a few minutes to really build a relationship with them, get them to trust you, and develop a plan with your decision-making that the patient is comfortable with.
Right. So once it's decided that they're going to be admitted, then you decide where they're going to go.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah. And how do you, I guess you just, you base it on, you need to conduct some tests first, I would imagine.
Exactly. If somebody is very sick, like if they're extremely ill and require a critical level of care, then we may ask our ICU colleagues to take over. Anything other than that, the hospital has different levels of different kinds of floors. Some floors are for the sicker patients who need more intense monitoring or more intense nursing care. Other floors, they have a lesser amount of monitoring. Like in some floors, you can have their vitals checked every 4 hours. There might be other floors where you can check on a patient like every 6 to 8 hours. So you have to know as a hospitalist how sick your patient is, what part of the hospital, what floor of the hospital is the right setting for them. Like, do they have to be intensely monitored? Or sometimes we get a cancer patient who's actively on treatment. And that for those kind of patients, you want them to be on the oncology floor.
Right.
For a stroke patient or somebody with a neurological condition, you would want them to be on the neuro floor, and you would gear their treatment towards that. And because the other part of it is that while we have great nurses all over the hospital, nurses do differ by training, and on the oncology floor, they are geared more towards those patients. And on the neuro and even on the ortho floors, those nurses are more trained towards handling the unique needs of those particular patient sets. So it's really quite a responsibility. Like, I can't put somebody who's having an active heart attack on an ortho floor because those nurses might not be trained enough to recognize how quickly a cardiac patient can decompensate. So it's a huge responsibility to know where to put your patient.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure.
Yes, it's a lot of pressure because if you don't do it right, it could set the tone for the patient's hospital stay, and you may end up in a situation where somebody's care gets possibly delayed because subtle changes were not picked up on. So it's a lot of pressure, but that's what I do.
How do you handle that? Like, as you said, you make the wrong decision, it's a big deal. So, you know, if you've been doing it for a while, I would imagine it's kind of routine, but you don't want to fall back into a routine either, right?
And I think that the way I handle it is I look at it, it's a very challenging, engaging, and diverse specialty. And no 2 days on the job are alike. You know, you have to look at every situation with a new perspective. And one of the biggest things is that while medicine remains the same, you know, there's an art to it and there's a science to it. The science remains the same, but you have to know that your patients did not read the textbook.
Right.
You have to apply your knowledge to a particular situation. And one of the things is I never go into a room with blinders on that this patient has a fractured hip. So this is what they need. I mean, they may have a fractured hip, but why did they fall? So once you start looking into these things, you start getting more detail, you can actually help them more than just taking care of their hip.
Right. You can discover other things. Can you give us an example of when that happened where it seemed like a routine fall or a routine anything, and then you discovered a whole lot more that you weren't expecting? Or you're always looking for that, I would imagine.
I think I'm always looking for that. Definitely. It did happen with me once.
Okay.
In fact, in that very same context that I had this patient who was actually, I got her, like I started my week on service, and the day I got her was her first post-operative day. unfortunately, she wasn't very mobile to begin with, and she had a severe history of depression. She lived alone. So I didn't really have much of history to go by, but I'd taken care of her in the past for other reasons when she'd been hospitalized, and I could feel that something was off this time. So I ended up doing more testing, and I found out that unfortunately that time she did have a stroke that wasn't picked up on because of her other social and health issues, but that's why she essentially fell at home. It's happened very commonly. You walk into one thing and you find like 10 other things going on.
So the stroke thing, you bring that up because I know I have heard of times when people will go into the hospital for something and then you're able to determine that they had a stroke or a series of strokes over the course of time that's happened in the past. I find that fascinating. Like, it's almost like their body is like a computer and it makes a little timestamp.
It does. And I think that that's what we do. That's what makes it so challenging. And you just can't walk in with a preconceived notion. You have to keep an open mind and you have to listen to your patients. That's the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the most important thing is that listen to them, listen to the family members and try to hear what they're trying to tell you. Because what I may get is, she's not herself, or she stopped eating.
Mm-hmm.
But why? The why is my job.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, because we had an episode with my mother-in-law where she had had a series of strokes, just like we were just talking about, and we didn't know about it. But she had to be admitted back in the hospital, you know, weeks later after she had been released. And then the doctor said to her, "Are you speaking okay?" And she says, "Yeah, I'm good." And so because another family member was there, happened to be my sister-in-law, said to her, no, have her say a longer sentence. Because when she said a longer sentence, that's when her speech started to slur. So there's stuff like that that you're looking for as well. I mean, you have a lot to look for when someone comes in, because you're seeing them basically not for the first time, but once they come to you, you have to do a full inspection.
In a way, yes. And, you know, we don't have the benefit of having a previous relationship with that patient.
Right.
So we're seeing them for that first time, and we have to figure out, you know, the most important thing is figure out why they're there. But in doing that, you have to have the full pieces of the puzzle in order to piece it together and know which way things are going to go, move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, families are a tremendous resource. For me, talking to families to find out why grandma or grandpa aren't themselves or how they've been at home over the past year or two, hearing that from a family member who's caring and concerned and involved in their life, it's the best tool that I have as a physician. I also, you know, as a physician, you also always have that opportunity to reach out to your colleagues who may have taken care of them in the past and get more information that way. And now that computer records are so convenient to get. It's, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do now that were harder to do a few years back, but still nothing replaces a good history and good communication and observation for family members.
Yeah, the communication is the key. So have you ever experienced someone who said, yeah, they'd be interested in doing this particular job? Maybe they're in medical school and you see that, yeah, I don't think they're the right person for the job because they're kind of introverted and maybe that wouldn't work. Have you ever experienced that or heard of that happening? Because you can't just put anybody in this job, any doctor in this job, right?
No, it has to be somebody who has the patience to listen and to communicate and to spend time doing coordinating things. Is, you know, sometimes it takes hours just for one patient, and you still have to see your other patients. So I think when I look at younger medical students and, you know, hear about if somebody wants to be a hospitalist, what I tell them is that you, no matter what you do, you have to love your job.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it because most hospitalist jobs are their shift work, and in shift work, you can have a schedule and a seven on, like we work 7 days for the most common model is you work 7 days and you're off 7 days. Oh. And I tell them that, you know, it looks great. And the 7 days off in a stretch, you know, sound wonderful. And the flexibility is amazing. But when you're on the job, you know, it requires 100% of you. And sometimes you have to advocate for your patients. Sometimes you have to go above and beyond for them. And sometimes you may not agree with a specialist about which way things are going and have to stand up for your patient and advocate for them. So it's a tough job, and I tell them that only do it if they truly love it.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you, obviously. Why wouldn't I be honest with you, right? You know, I talk to lots of different types of doctors on this program, and, you know, I'll give, say, brain surgeons as an example. I'm like, wow, that's a high-pressure job. Your job seems to be just as much pressure, or maybe even more, because of the decision-making, this snap decision-making that you need to make.
Yeah, and I think that the decision-making can weigh you down.
Mm-hmm.
Because just to give you an example, somebody comes in with a bleed and they have a history of stroke. You know, one specialist is going to say, yes, they need the blood thinner to prevent further strokes. And then there's going to be another person advising, you can't really have blood thinners because you just had a big bleed. So my job is to sit down with the patients and the family, give them the numbers of what their chances are for each eventuality happening, that if they're off their blood thinners, they might have a stroke. If they continue to take the blood thinners, they might have another bleeding episode.
Right.
My job is to sit them down, go over the numbers, see what eventuality they're prepared to live with, what consequences they're prepared to live with, and help them make a decision. That part is the hardest, because whatever decision they make that day, you know, I know I have a part in it, and I know that either way, it could have repercussions and, you know, life-changing repercussions for the patient and their family. And sometimes you have to sit down with them and have discussions about goals of care. They may have treatment options, but somebody, based on, like the patient, based on their other medical conditions, may be at the end of their road. And to sit down with them and talk about what treatment options they have, what quality of life they may get from those treatment options. Should they be getting aggressive care? It's hard because it's a huge decision, and the families, patients, sometimes family members look at you and say, what would you do if this was your mother?
Right. Is that how you think of it?
Honestly, it's very hard to think of it like that.
Okay.
But what I say to them is that this is not what I would do, and this is not what you would do. This is about what your parent or your loved one would want to do if they were part of this discussion.
Yeah,
and we have to make the best decision knowing what their wishes would be.
Yeah, it's telling, you know, you said you need a lot of patience, and we talked about what you need to be a hospitalist, but you need to have a lot of compassion, too. You need to put yourself in the place of the patient and the patient's family when you're talking about this. That could take a lot out of you.
It can. And we're lucky that, you know, at least with my at JFK, we're lucky that we have a great support system in place with our palliative care program and our hospice program, where we have other providers who can come and either be part of those discussions or reinforce those discussions in their own separate meetings with the patients and family members. But no matter how many other people are involved, they have to hear it from their attending first. And that's where our responsibility doesn't stop if somebody else is involved doing the same thing. We only get some help from that.
You mentioned earlier that it's 7 days on, 7 days off. Is that common for any other positions? Because I've heard of like, fours and threes or something like that, 3 days on, 4 days off or something like that. But I never heard of seven and seven. Is there a reason they do that with hospitalists?
The reason they do that is to give continuity, and because in the hospital stay, you're looking at certain metrics. One of them is length of stay. One of them is patient satisfaction. So especially for patient satisfaction, it's a huge thing to have the same provider rather than have two or three different providers
for
services within the same hospital stay. So that's why it's designed to provide that kind of a stretch.
Yeah.
And of course, if there is, you know, in any particular situation, there is flexibility around the 7 day working stretch. But the idea is to give people some continuity. You know, if the same person is seeing them every day, they know what they're doing. They have their diagnostic plan. They know what their treatment plan is, and they can work on a safe transition out of the hospital, because that's very important too. Part of it is because, you know, from the hospital side, one of their metrics that they worry about is their length of stay. From the physician side, what we worry about is that after a certain point, you have to weigh the risks versus benefits of keeping your patient in the hospital.
Is there a big transition when you go, you know, you said 7 days on. So let's say day six, someone is admitted and you start caring for them, but then you're leaving in a couple days. They're still going to be there. Let's say the seventh day, is there a major discussion between you and other hospitalists who are taking over? Or is everything just written down?
We do have a system for handoff. And then we do tell our patients, like if I know that they're going to be here, I always tell them that my colleague, Dr. XYZ, will take care of you going forward. And I will make sure that I update them about all the things that we have discussed.
What are some of the things you do to reduce the readmissions, people coming back? And also, when someone gets to, you know, you get them at the beginning, and then they get all the treatment and the care that they need, and then it's time for them to be discharged. What's the process there?
So one of the things that we've started to do at JFK to reduce readmissions is one of the biggest resources is having an on-site pharmacy. The biggest challenge that I do find with people is filling their prescriptions or going home and finding out, oh, my new medication that the doctor discharged me with is not covered by my insurance.
Okay.
So having an on-site pharmacy and using the Medicaid Meds to Vet program, which essentially means that we send the medication to the pharmacy either ahead of time or at the time of discharge and let them know that the patient is leaving today or tomorrow. Can you please fill the script? And then involving a clinical pharmacist in doing some teaching for the medication. That's the other thing that we've been working on. One of the things that also helps is trying to set up an outpatient appointment before they leave the hospital. We've piloted it with our heart failure patients, and we are looking at expanding that. Sometimes I would be proactive and reach out to the primary myself and say, and so would any of my other colleagues, by the way, would reach out to them and say, hey, this patient was admitted for this reason and they will need follow-up, maybe, or we change their medications, or they will need follow-up blood work in a week's time. So that gives the primary some heads up about what to expect and when to follow up. We do send notes. Like any hospital note, especially a discharge note, gets sent to the primary. So, I mean, all in all, I think there's always room for improvement, but we're trying.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ghazia Pervaiz, hospitalist physician at JFK. Thanks for coming on the program and sharing everything. This is all new to me, so I very interesting.
My pleasure, Joel. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, thank you. For more info, go to jfkmc.org. If you'd like a podcast of the show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. This is JFK Spotlight. I'm Joel Katz, JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better, and we will talk to you next week.